title of my message tonight is Jesus Tried Before Annas and Caiaphas. This is the 27th in a series on the life of Jesus. An hour after his arrest at midnight in the Garden of Gethsemane on the Mount of Olives, Jesus was in the upper city of Jerusalem at the well-known palace of Annas, still bound at his wrist as though he might fight or attempt to outrun them. He was led through gateways and corridors, up broad staircases, and at length into a large room made soundproof by thick hangings. By the light of the smoking tapers, he sees a semicircle of 23 seats and the expectant faces of a few silent councilmen, all chief priests, Sadducees, all sitting upon large cushions. In the middle of these sat the venerable Annas, who was elevated from one of the chief priests to high priest in 7 AD by the governor of Syria and deposed 8 years later by the next ruler. But Annas continued to wield great power as the dominant member of the hierarchy, using members of his family as willing instruments. For the Jews highly esteemed this man who possessed such commanding influence. The actions of Rome were only political and legal. They had no influence on the Sadducee in regard for this son of Seth, figurehead of the nation. True, he could not be legally the high priest now, but he could be, in fact, the high priest, ruling through his son-in-law, Caiaphas Joseph, who later would preside over the trial of Peter and John. For never would the council get rid of the influence of this man, Jesus. But the apostles would be rid of the council when Jerusalem fell in 70 A.D. An adroit diplomat, five of his sons and his son-in-law, Caiaphas, held the priesthood since he was deposed in unbroken succession. He would not live to see his fifth son put James, the Lord's half-brother, to death in 62 A.D. Indeed, the office of Caiaphas was called the High Priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas, as if they were joint holders of the title. The Jews could hold him in any unofficial title they wanted. And if Caiaphas listened and followed the decisions of Annas, well, that was his business. These arrogant, astute, ambitious, and enormously wealthy Sadducean high priests gained their riches chiefly through the sale of sacrifices, bullocks, lambs, doves, pigeons, wine, and oil, carried on in the four famous booths of the son of Annas on the Mount of Olives and in the precincts of the temple itself. During the feast, they were able to extort high monopoly prices for their goods. Now Jesus stood in front of this powerful leader, but technically his actions would have no legal bearing on what would happen to Jesus. The judgment of this venerate sage would only be taken under advisement by the Supreme Court. The head of the Sanhedrin, Caiaphas, would steer the council his way, the way of Annas. Annas was the ruling spirit and prime mover of all that followed with Jesus at his trial. To the Romans, Annas was a safe churchman, not troubled with any special convictions, nor with Jewish fanaticism. He was a pleasant and useful man who was able to furnish his friends in the praetorium with large sums of money as necessary for any occasion. Now Christ, the Son of the living God, stood before this one whose skin in the lamplight took on the appearance of ancient parchment of the law. In expectation of the capture, a company of chief priests were already assembled. These aged jackals, puppets of Annas, scrutinized the Galilean prophet, but he did not return the interest. Anna speaks, "What is the name of your disciples?" And his court scribe sat pen ready to list the names in case the high priest would order their arrest so that all would fear to join the upstart rabbi. 12 men on crosses would put fear in the hearts of the city from following Jesus of Nazareth. Without the chief philosopher in his cabinet, surely his doctrine would dissipate as water poured out on the sand of the desert. The question was illegal. Jesus was not bound by law to answer it, and he knew it. They were here to accuse him on a specific charge, not to go on a fishing expedition as to his unarrested friends. Jesus stood silent without an answer. The aged judge was miffed, but he knew the accused remained silent on legal grounds. Jesus was not about to give his friends into the hands of this crooked council. Next question. What is thy doctrine? A more palatable question for a loyalist who won't betray his followers. Also an illegal question, for the trial was to be because of his doctrine, discovered, not to face an excuse to try him who was already arrested and brought to trial. This time Jesus answered, "I spoke openly to the world. Always I taught publicly in the synagogues and temple where all the Jews assemble. I have said nothing in secret. You have had plenty of opportunity to know my doctrine. Why do you question me? Question those who have heard me as to what I said to them. Behold, they know what I said." And this was a way of saying, follow your law, get your information from witnesses. And at this stinging truth, flying back in the face of the unjust judge, who judged illegally at night, demanding answers that were clearly illegal, Annas' face grew livid with rage. "This man does not fear me. He dares put me in my place, correcting me in my procedures." All felt his embarrassment. Slap! A stinging hand across his mouth and face, followed with a rough rebuff. "Do you dare answer the high priest so?" the officer who struck him illegally asks. The head of Jesus knocked hard to one side, came back to its upright position. And with eyes of calmness, without hate, without rancor, without the fires of hurt pride, he looked at the acting high priest and calmly said, "If I spoke wrongly, bear witness of the wrong. For you know it to be the truth, and the right of the accused to defend himself. But if I spoke within the law," not saying that Annas spoke outside the law, "why do you strike me?" Annas, knowing that he himself was the one that was wrong, and that all who sat before him also knew it, stood showing the dignity of the long high priestly robe. And to himself he says, "This man refuses to answer, and he's within his rights. We have no specific charges against him, and we have no witnesses. We cannot convict a silent man who will not implicate himself if we have no witnesses. He must be charged guilty and die, but upon some grounds. I had hoped he would implicate himself so we could judge him guilty of blasphemy and treason in his pre-court before sending our findings on with him to the legal full court under Caiaphas, who would read our preliminary findings and recommendations so they would pursue the same course of inquiry and judgment. But alas, we will have to procure witnesses as soon as the sun is up against him." Then to the council, Annas announces, "Yeshua of Nazareth, a town of no reputation, one which the scriptures say nothing concerning the coming of a Messiah, has, according to general and public knowledge, made himself to be Messiah and King of the Jews. Moreover, he teaches contrary to the laws of Moses and the custom of the Jews, exciting new riot and seditious emotions at the time of our solemn feasts, even Passover, and has been arrested for his crimes against the Jewish nation. He has remained silent throughout this pre-arraignment, not taking advantage of the opportunity to defend himself against the accusation of the chief priests by explaining his innocency. If he were innocent, why does he not say so? Where is his purity of heart and actions? He demands by his silence that we find out his very crimes, and we will do so. I order this seditious man to be tried in the court of the Sanhedrin. Witnesses will be summoned against him to prove the charges. He will be examined and found out. If he is found to be guilty of treason against our nation, he shall die. Take the prisoner away." And with this speech, the old goat relieved himself of his embarrassment and justified his illegal course of action, implied but not stated by the accused. In fact, Annas felt proud of how his speech made him feel exonerated and justified, and it gave him some measure of satisfaction, for his threat would surely come true and give him final revenge over this too calm and self-assured criminal who should be shaking in his sandals. Jesus was led out of the palace into the night under custody of a large band of temple guards toward the palace house of Caiaphas. The arrest had taken place at the sixth hour of the night, midnight, and by the seventh hour he was back in the city, in the palace of Annas. Many other questions had been put to Jesus, none of which he would answer. Intervening accusations and statements were made to prod the accused into defense, but he gave none. Summary speeches and legal blah-blah ended the nefarious illegal night trial. No judgment was made. Indeed, none could be made under the circumstances. It was time to send him to Caiaphas. Lamps outlined the procession of the ruling priests and the guards in the dark streets of the upper city. No one was seen. They were all asleep, for daylight brought the busy Passover feast. The distance to Caiaphas' house was short, The secret would be kept from Christ's followers in the lower city, and even from his smaller following in the upper city and suburbs. The Passover is at full moon, and God's silvery moon looked down at the night procession, casting its silvery light all over their heads and shoulders and down the front of their robes and faces. Now, Simon Peter, the ex-fisherman who was overly zealous with his anti-robber sword in the Garden of Gethsemane, followed the night raiders who had his captured rabbi. Simeon followed afar off by watching the lights in the darkness. He had ran from the soldiers, but only in a circuit of the Garden of Gethsemane, for he must see what will happen to his beloved master and friend. He waited in the dark upstreet from Annas' palace till Jesus emerged, bound at his wrist and surrounded by officers and elders. The Romans had finished with their backup duty and had retired to the fortress. Peter now follows in the darkness of the moonlight shadows, a half stadium behind the captors. A short distance brings them to the house of Caiaphas, a palace with an inner and outer court. The big fisherman stood in the shadow of a large bush at the end of the court and watched the light of the palace spring out of the now open door, and three of the four leading Sanhedrists, John, Alexander, and Annas, entered, followed by other leading Jews. Then Jesus and the officers went in, and the door was shut. Peter moved across the court towards the door. Perhaps he could open it a crack and peek in if the doorkeeper did not remain right at the door. Or perhaps he could put his ear to the crack and hear. Not likely. Could he peer into the lattices from outside in the dark? He must try. Suddenly, Simon heard two figures approaching the court. He ducked into the shadow just as they entered the courtyard. He heard them talk of the trial and knew they were more councilmen. Apparently, the rest of the Sanhedrin was being summoned. He would have to be careful. Peter had to duck into the shadows a few more times as other Sanhedrists entered. He found no view, nor could he hear anything. It was evident the doorkeeper kept right at the door. A long hour passed. What was happening inside those marble walls? Only a few stars remained in the lightning skies. Soon he would be clearly seen if he remained where he was. He must try the door one more time. Perhaps the doorkeeper was satisfied that all were now within and would relax his vigil. Peter moved up to the large, heavy doors and took hold of the large brass handle, gently pulled to see if it was secured. It was not. It cracked open, and Simon's eyes through the crack could see a large skirt right inside the door. He quietly let the weight of the door pull itself closed. He heard footsteps behind him. Whirling, he saw another councilman halfway through the court approaching him. He had been caught. Peter thought it best to leave the court at once. Perhaps the judge would say nothing if he left, especially if he left via the alternate walkway. Not looking at the approaching man, Peter tried to walk fast, but he tried his best to look casual, too. But the man walked over to Peter quickly and said, "Simon, is that you?" Peter whirled. It was the councilman he had seen at the house of Lazarus in Bethany, the one who talked all night with Jesus. "My name is Nicodemus. I have been summoned to the trial of Yeshua. Ever since that night I met him in Bethany, I have been a secret believer. The council is determined to put him to death. Joseph of Arimathea and Jacob of Bethel and I are the one with you, but there's little we can do except to try to see to it that the rest of the Sanhedrin holds to the law. Do you want in?" Peter's eyes grew big, and his heart started to pound. His head nodded, but he wasn't sure now that it might be possible. Yet he had to see what happened. "Yes, yes, yes," he would enter if he could. "I can get you in, I think. It's a bit risky, but everything is falling apart now anyway. The end is in sight for Jesus and his disciples and for the Jewish nation if they put the Messiah to death. Wait here." And Nicodemus pulled the door open and entered. After a few heart pounding moments, the Jewish ruler came back out and said, "Come." And he motioned in Peter with his arm. Peter now stood in the inner court and looked about him. The councilman retired to the great hall. The temple guards waited in the open inner court about a fire, for it was chilly tonight. Peter joined them, for it was less conspicuous to mingle with the servants and officers than to stand alone, lest he be approached and questioned. These servants and guards knew nothing. He could mingle with them, Peter reasoned. Nicodemus joined the rest of the judges in the hall to await the rest of the justices. Now, this other disciple, or as it is in the better Greek manuscripts, another disciple, whom I have decided was Nicodemus, was not one of the 12, for one of them would not be called another disciple. It was not John, as most have imagined, purely in the fact that he was mentioned only by John and was unnamed, as John's custom was when referring to himself. In the first place, John always called himself the disciple whom Jesus loved, except in one instance where he makes it plain that he is the one referred to. He would not call himself another disciple. More importantly, John could not be well known to Caiaphas. He was an obscure fisherman in far-off Galilee. Nor was he known to the high priest as having sold him fish, as one commentator ventures. For Peter did not fish about Jerusalem. He would not ply his Galilean trade as far south as Jerusalem. Besides, high priest did no business with fishermen. His servants took care of such mundane business. Nor was John related to Caiaphas, as another suggested. If he were, Peter and Andrew would also have truck with him. But this is absurd. Caiaphas would not be a relative of a Galilean. He was the son-in-law of Annas, a Judean Sadducee, not a despised Galilean. Moreover, Caiaphas presided over the trial of Peter and John later, according to the book of Acts. Nor was the other disciple, James, the Lord's half-brother from Nazareth, as another scholar guesses. He would not know Caiaphas. Nor would John or James be allowed into the judgment hall. Only councilmen were permitted. Nor would James be aware of these secret proceedings at night, as he wasn't in the garden when Christ was arrested. Nor was the disciple the master of the house that Jesus stayed at, as suggested by still another commentator. He was no councilman. He would know nothing of the arrest, nor would he be permitted into the hall. The disciple had to be on the Supreme Court. And the only such one that John, the author of his gospel, knew was Nicodemus. Peter was restless and ill at ease. He was within the palace, but still without the hall of judgment. What was going on? He sat down with the servants by the fire and listened to the talk. Then he stood, then sat, and then stood. It was this restlessness of attempted indifference which attracted the maid who had first admitted him. In the flickering light of the fire, she studied him, scanning his troubled face. Suddenly she questioned, "You are not one of his disciples, are you?" Not saying who his was, for the conversation was of the arrested prophet. For why was he troubled so? Why was he here, neither servant, nor guard, nor councilman? She saw his well-worn cloak, used to the ground of Gethsemane. He spake not, but he reacted in his face differently than the others. Is he? He must be, she thought. Thou also wast with the Nazarene, even Jesus, she added. Then turning to the officers, she said the more confidently, seeing that Peter's face was quivering and he had not answered, "This man also was with him." Peter looked into the alarmed eyes of the startled officers. Quickly he turned his eyes to the accusing maid of the high priest and said with a loud, defensive voice, "I neither know nor understand what thou sayest. I know him not." And fearing to remain, he arose and went out to the colonnaded porch, leaving the open inner courtyard. As his footfall sounded along the marble-paved porch, the upcoming apostle, who was to hold the keys to the nations and be a piece of the rock, heard a cock crow at the streaks of light shining over the eastern hills. But he paid no heed, for he had heard chickens crow every morning. "Why should I incriminate myself by needless confession?" he said to himself. "These common people have no legal or moral right to the answer to her allegation. I am not an oath before justices," he reasoned. Peter milled about the colonnades a bit, pacing alone. But although he felt more at ease away from the piercing eyes of that woman, he felt so conspicuous. Maybe he'd better return to the fire. Besides, it was cold in the porch. Peter heard steps in the corridor. More judges were arriving. Peter hurried back to the fire. There was no conversation now. Instead, all studied Peter's expression as he gazed intently into the fire and rubbed his cold hands, not daring to look into their stares. The porter was more sure now than ever, and she trusted her feelings. She said to the others, "This is one of them. This man also was with Jesus the Nazarene." And seeing that Peter said nothing, an officer turned to him and accused, "Thou art also one of them." And he pointed his finger accusingly. "Art thou also one of his disciples?" the group chorused, feeling that now they have seized upon something big. "Man, I am not," Peter hotly denied, looking at the first accusing officer. And Peter took an oath. "As God liveth, I know not the man." And at the oath, the jackals pulled back from him, realizing that they could be wrong. Besides, they had no legal power over this man, nor did anyone say that the disciples were to be arrested too. Jesus was now brought into the great hall, where the high priest would sit in council with the chief officers of the temple, and sometimes try minor cases, saving him from going to court. This hall was arranged in the manner of the great Sanhedrin, which is at the western entrance of the temple, lying just outside its walls. That court is known as the hall or chamber of the hewn stones. But here the dimensions are smaller, but the interior more elegant. One end of the hall was in the form of a half circle, 23 benches were cut into the wall, enough for a quorum, all that was called for minor cases. The center bench was raised above the others. Caiaphas, the high priest, already was seated, as were the other councilmen, but by now 48 more men had taken all the extra chairs and others brought in. For by now the full Sanhedrin was there for this illegal night trial, but they will attempt to fix that legal detail later. All the justices had short royal capes. The high priest and chief justice had a long flowing purple robe. To the right and left of the raised bench sat the recorders with a set of cut feather quills and a roll of parchment ready. One would record the prosecution, the other the defense. A large number of oil lamps hung from the ceiling, and to these lights were added the flames of fireballs of red marble. Fires blazed above each magistrate seated along the wall. Crimson and purple hangings decorated the marble walls. A polished cedar ceiling, carved geometrically, without any images of man or beast, softened the appearance of the hard marble floor and walls. Jewish law clearly stated that death penalties must be discussed one day and confirmed the next. The 24-hour day started at 6 p.m. and ran to 6 p.m. the following night. But since the matter of getting rid of this false Messiah is so urgent, it will be enough to count this night as the first day and the next morning as the second day. Bring the prisoner forth, the chief magistrate ordered. Two guards led him, still bound, to the place before the judges. Untie his hands, the judge ordered, for he knew that a bevy of guards stood just outside the courtroom door to prevent him from fleeing. This session, Caiaphas began, being careful not to call it a court, for it was a non-legal night hearing. This session has been called due to the extreme urgency of the situation. The priestly judge began, trying to make the illegal proceedings seem as justifiable as possible. This man, Jesus of Nazareth, standing before me, has been accused of bringing the city and nation to the brink of sedition, climaxing at the time of our holy feast, forcing us to convene at such an hour lest the feast of God Almighty be thrown into bloodshed and confusion, and the troops of Rome be upon us. We will therefore examine this man by our law, that we might proceed with the emergency examination undertaken by Annas during the night, which became necessary by the urgency pressed upon us. But this man has refused to recognize our emergency session, and now he is here to be tried by the full council. And looking down upon the Galilean, he asked, "You are Jesus of Nazareth, are you not?" But Jesus gave no answer, but only nodded. For the court was illegal and prejudiced, and they already knew the answer. "He is!" the prosecutor snapped, angered at Christ for showing no respect to God's right-hand man. "All right, bring in the witness against the accused," Caiaphas ordered, for first they needed to know what the specific charges were. Anna had ordered witnesses, and he gave a sack of drachmas to each officer of the temple to hire some good ones from among the sleepers. "Of course we are paying them for their inconveniences, not the witnessing," he had said, defending his illegal orders. Now they were herded in, mainly from the lower city, where drachma was more than ample compensation for a half night's lost sleep and a false witness. "Have the witnesses face the accused and make their charge," the presiding magistrate directed. And the prosecutor motioned an old man with a limp to the stand in front of Jesus. "This man has troubled your good conscience and soul and your piety to God by his heresies?" the prosecutor began. The man nodded, trying not to look into the eyes of the master, who looked with pity on this poor soul, who would get up in the middle of the night to accuse a stranger for a day's wages, a week's earnings for him. "Answer with words," the prosecutor said, trying to be patient. "What do you want me to say?" the old white-haired, balding, and bearded man quizzed. "Tell this court what you heard this impostor say that shocked your piety and orthodoxy," the prosecutor said, hoping to remind the forgetful old codger of the previous talk. "Yes, I remember," the old man cracked. "He said that he would burn this temple down." "Do you mean destroy it?" the prosecutor asked, embarrassed at him not remembering the rumor in his lines. "Yes, that's what I said," the aged man answered. "Burn or destroy?" Nicodemus cut in, and the other councilman looked at him with disgust, as if an emergency trial of a heretic, such precision were necessary. Had he not heard the pretrial talk by Caiaphas? Let's keep the legalities simple and get to the point, he had told them. Did he say he would burn the temple or destroy the temple? The prosecutor asked. And when the man hesitated, he added, you heard him say destroy. Is that not correct, sir? And the man nodded and gave an uncertain yes. The prosecution is leading the witness, Nicodemus cut in. Don't lead the witness, Caiaphas said as he scowled at Nicodemus. That's all, sir. You may go. Thank you for your valuable witness of this seditious traitor threatening to destroy the temple ordained by God by the hand of Solomon and graced by our Herod, the prosecutor said as he waved off the flunky witness who thanked him. Next witness, the prosecutor ordered, and he waved forward a fat Jewish woman in her 40s, poorly dressed. And what evil did this man to your pure heart and ears and soul do, the Jewish attorney prompted. Well, sir, he's an evil man, a liar and a charlatan, a false prophet, false messiah, and a no-good vagabond. He isn't worthy of our city. I think he should be put to death, she blurted out in feigned rage. Objection, Nicodemus said boldly. This is an opinion, not a witness. There were no facts presented, and the copy stopped his writing. Ask the witness to speak specifically, the judge ordered. Woman, what exactly has led you to these conclusions? The Jewish law agent asked, smiling at her to set her at ease. Well, he said all sorts of things, she snapped, miffed at being corrected. Like what? Name some of them, the prosecutor pleaded, wishing this officer had paid for more high-class witness. Well, he said he was a prophet and the Messiah, the woman said matter-of-factly. Anything else, the prosecutor urged? No, I don't think so, except I know he's a fake, she said. Woman, Joseph cut in, do you have any facts to support your pious opinions as to why this Jesus is not a prophet? She looked bewildered. No, except I don't think he is one, she answered. In other words, you don't know, but it is your guess. And Joseph laid stress on the word guess, that he isn't. Is this correct? Yes, I guess so, she answered, and the prosecutor and half the councilman flushed. And do you have any proof that he isn't the Messiah? Joseph continued. No, she answered, making it short. Then guesses hardly seem worthy of her outrage and demand of death, Joseph added, for our law demands proof of guilt beyond any doubt. Now, these were typical words for all the elite judges, except that they usually judge more precise, knowledgeable, and educated witnesses. But it outraged the Sadducees that these two Pharisees were opposing their design by such niceties with regard to the witnesses of uneducated rabble concerning this seditious and false Messiah that troubled Israel. Next witness, the barrister said, and a fat Jew as bald as a desert rock waddled up to the stand in front of Jesus, and he stuck his belly out at him and said without being asked, I heard you say out of your own mouth into my ears that you were going to resurrect and go away after we kill you. And the prosecutor blushed at the word we. And what else? Is all the further the prosecutor got when Nicodemus cut in again. Pardon me, sir, but does your witness have any proof of the falsity of the statement allegedly said? Well, his statement is ludicrous, the attorney shot back. You are not the witness, neither the judge, Nicodemus corrected. Please direct the question to the witness. And the prosecutor rephrased the question to, is it your teaching from the synagogues that the Messiah would be slain and resurrected? And as Nicodemus was about to object, the man answered, I don't go to any synagogue. And even the Sadducees laughed. The prosecutor, knowing his case was lost, dismissed the witness and the next two in line and called up a well-dressed man with one eye. And the two paid witnesses who did not have to witness congratulated each other with smiles in the hearing of all. So, the attorney snapped, trying desperately to get some solid testimony, give this court all the clear-cut proof and specific statements you have as to the treasonous statements made by this man that you yourself have personally heard from his own lips. Trying to avoid further blunders, for this looked to be one of his most capable witnesses, a man obviously from the upper city. Esteemed men of the council and venerated chief magistrate, the volunteer began as the prosecutor relaxed. I am a Pharisee, a member in good standing of the synagogue, a learned teacher of Hebrew, Greek, and Latin, a supporter of our nation under God. I have heard this man, Jesus of Galilee, many times in our city, once in Bethlehem. He has clearly stated on several occasions that he does and says only that which his heavenly Father tells him, making him the Son of God. But God has no son, for to be a son of God is to make one equal with God. This is blasphemy against God and worthy of death according to the law of Moses, which both Pharisees and Sadducees agree to. Moreover, hold it, sir, Nicodemus interrupted. I have a question for the witness. Yes, the witness asked, smiling. So do you believe that we are Ben Elohim, sons of God? Not literally, sir, but I believe that Jesus was speaking literally, or else his statement would have no meaning. And Caiaphas and the others smiled, or suppressed a smile. Do you believe that Adam was literally a son of God? Nicodemus pressed. Yes, the man felt obliged to answer. And are angels also Ben Elohim? Nicodemus asked. And again, a simple yes. Well then, do you believe that Adam and the angels were the same substance as the Creator, being Ben Elohim? Nicodemus urged. Although Nicodemus did believe that Jesus was born of God through a virgin, as Christ had shared with him in answer to his probing theological questions in Bethany, though the Lord opened up the truth of the prophets to him. No, sir, the witness said. Well then, Nicodemus asked, what proof have you of blasphemy by Jesus by implying that he also is the Son of God? And the man thought hard, hunting for an answer. But finding none, confided, it seems to me, sir, that for a rabbi to continually call attention to the fact that he is God's son, when no other rabbi does so, is to imply that he is more of a son of God in some unique way than they. It seems to you, or it states in Jewish law? Nicodemus asked, warming up to the occasion. After all, such questions are proper for any judge. Besides, no one can prove that he too is a follower just for pressing the witness. They all did this in every case, but this one. It seems to me so, the man admitted, being able to cite no Jewish law. And since when is implying something against the law, Nicodemus asked. Our law requires direct quotations and statements be judged, not implications, which are at the whim of every man. And the witness nodded in understanding, having no defense. And why is being unique unlawful? Nicodemus continued, pressing his advantage. Even to being the Son of God, the witness asked cautiously. We've covered that, Nicodemus answered, and the man nodded, seeing that they had made the full circle. You may proceed, Nicodemus directed the prosecutor, who now greatly hoped that other members of the council would help him out against Nicodemus's questionings. Have you heard this Galilean make any other impious claims? The lawman asked. Objection, Nicodemus cut in. And Caiaphas looked at the light coming in through the windows from the lightning sky of the morning, wondering if the Supreme Court judge, Nicodemus, was going to hold up the conviction by his technicalities. It has not been established that the accused has made any impious claims, so don't say any other claims. The prosecutor nodded assent and continued, have you, good sir, heard this man make any blasphemous, impious, or treasonous remarks? The lawyer corrected. Yes, sir, I have, came back the clear reply. He has stated that God has given him all power over demons and sickness. Now, we Pharisees acknowledge that the prophets exercise power over sickness in some cases. But to say that he has all power makes him equal with God, as God's son, and not just a product son of God. Nicodemus poked Joseph's knee for him to knock down the allegation, feeling that he best not be a one-man show. Question for the witness, Joseph shouted. Of course, the prosecutor said, smiling. So tell us, if you acknowledge that the accused has ever healed any sick or cast out demons from any man, Joseph asked. Yes, sir, I do acknowledge that in some cases the evidences are overwhelming that he has. But I am objecting to, just answer my question, sir, Joseph cut in. Do you acknowledge that he has attempted myriads of cures and deliverances? Yes, came back the reply. Very well, the Arimathean said. Do you know of any cases where he has failed? Hold it, shouted the Sadducean judge. That matter is a religious one of debate among us. We Sadducees do not recognize demons nor healings. This is no place for theological questions of debate. I am not asking you your theology, Joseph shot back. I am asking a Pharisee that does believe. And I'm not asking him theology, but rather facts according to his understanding. And the Sadducean judge slumped, knowing that he has lost the argument. Sir, do you know of any cases where Jesus has failed? Joseph proceeded. No, sir, I don't, came back the crisp acknowledgement. Then what proof have you that he who has not knowingly failed has not all power over sicknesses by the miracles he performs? Joseph pressed. I am talking theoretically, philosophically, and theologically, the teacher witness answered. Such things are opinions and not facts and have no place in court, Joseph of Arimathea returned. We cannot condemn a man on another's philosophy and theology, nor on theoretical grounds. Besides, 100% result is theoretically the same as all power, and practically, too. Are you saying Jesus has all power? Another superior judge shouted at Joseph angrily. Cease, Caiaphas ordered, seeing where this would lead. Gentlemen of the Sanhedrin, we came here to do a job, and we won't get it done if we don't proceed along, speaking no more, and cross-examine the witnesses no more than necessary. The chief magistrate remonstrated, guardedly, only vaguely hinting at the need to speed up the legal process. Have you, sir, yourself seen or heard this man, who is accused by esteemed Jews from every quarter, do or say anything else of note that would convict him? And the chief priest liked the term convict. Jesus stood patiently, not showing any emotion, for he was confirming his commitment to God in his soul and spirit. Yes, the teacher said, I saw him heal on the Sabbath day and be rebuked by the rabbi. Sabbath day breakers are to be stoned. And the prosecutor's eyes winked with glee, for this was a weighty matter with all the judges. Question, Nicodemus shouted out, to violate the Sabbath is indeed a serious breach of the law. So we, of course, must be careful to ascertain whether or not healing on the Sabbath is indeed a violation of the law. A physician must not practice on the Sabbath, an irate Pharisee and judge interrupted. This is my witness, Nicodemus remonstrated. This is also law. Your witness, Caiaphas stated, upset by the ineffective shots at Nicodemus. So was the sick man healed? Nicodemus asked. That is immaterial, a Sadducee justice broke in. This is my witness, and I assure you, my esteemed colleague, that my questions are very germane to the subject, the ruler Nicodemus counterclaimed. Honored colleague, Caiaphas intoned as he leaned forward and looked at Nicodemus. Must you counter every statement the witness makes? There are other justices also wishing to take part in these proceedings. Perhaps if you could confine your questions to the main areas of your concerns, we could get done before the feast day is over. Esteemed Chief Justice, Nicodemus says as he rises, a man is on trial for his life. We must not let hasty witnesses go unchecked. Surely we must of necessity know assuredly that this man is guilty before we pronounce our verdict. And all the faces of the council screwed up but two others. True, the feast day is at hand when we are not allowed to try any man. But we are not allowed to try anyone on the eve of the feast or at night. But if such an emergency overrides the law, and this is without precedence, surely we must abide by our oath and do our job to protect the... Hold your peace, Justice. I have called this assembly as an inquiry. Inquiries are not trials, nor subject to law of trials. This is a pretrial. Go on with your questioning of the witness. And all could see that the head judge was smoking mad. So, was the sick man healed? Nicodemus re-asked the witness. Yes, came the quick reply. Do you think this man from Nazareth healed the infirm man, or that God healed him? Or do you think the devil healed him, a Pharisee suggested. The witness answered, thankful for the steel, man cannot heal. And the God of Moses would not violate his law to Moses and break the Sabbath, the teacher answered. So the devil healed him. Does the devil do more good than God? Nicodemus pursued. Is he then good? Why then don't we worship him? Nicodemus asked. And coughing and moans could be heard all over the courtroom. And Jesus looked at Nicodemus and loved him. But Nicodemus dared not return the look. Well, sir, I cannot answer that, but neither can I answer why God would dishonor his own laws, the man answered honestly. Is God bound by his laws to man? Nicodemus pressed. Can he not do more than he allows man? Is he not higher than our laws? You're leading the witness, cried a Sadducee. I'm asking the witness, Nicodemus returned. You're suggesting to the witness, a half dozen magistrates shouted as they stood. You're leading the witness, Caiaphas ruled. Sorry, sir, Nicodemus said. So, and Nicodemus looked at the witness, is a man to be held guilty for what he himself does not do? If God healed the man and not man, who are you to object? But if he called upon the devil to heal him, is he not guilty regardless of who healed? The man asked logically. Did he call upon the devil? No, but he didn't call upon God either. Well then, did the man of Nazareth heal? Obviously not. Can you prove whether God or Satan did the healing? I remind you that you said you couldn't answer either way. No, I can't prove who healed the man. But even if God did heal him, which I suppose he did, for as you say, the devil would not do good, does it not still hold true that if the man initiates the action to God, then the man is guilty in violating the Sabbath, seeing that God is his medicine and he is the imitator? And the prosecutor beamed at his witness for his solid reasoning. Well, sir, one more question, Nicodemus said, as he saw the high priest fuming. If God thought it improper to ask for healing on the Sabbath, would he heal man and heal against his will? And the witness, mulling that over, had to say, no, God will not go against his own will. But neither will he go against his own law, sir. Well then, out of your own mouth, you have admitted that one, God healed, and two, God won't go against his will. So this was God's will. And you admitted that God won't go against his laws. So healing on the Sabbath does not violate God's laws. So how can you condemn a man for doing God's will and doing good when it does not violate God's law and when in fact it was God who did the healing? And the witness was speechless. And the ruler pressed him till he said, I can't. And Nicodemus felt proud of himself for his wisdom and did not know that he was opening up to God who was giving him both boldness and wisdom. And the witness, feeling his theology being buffeted and his convictions being cut asunder, looked upon Jesus and marveled. And then he saw the love in the Son of God's eyes, and he faltered, but looked away and declined to bring any more accusations against him. The next 10 witnesses gave garbled and contradictory accounts, and their testimonies were discounted for lack of agreement, even though they were all hired false witnesses. Then at last there came forward a witness who bore witness that the Galilean said that he would destroy the temple of God that is made with hands, and in 3 days he would build another one, not made with hands. And the prosecutor alleged this statement to be sabotage and heresy and blasphemy. And the next witness stood to bear witness to the same and testified under oath that he heard Jesus say, in 46 years I will destroy this temple and will rebuild it in 3 years and give it to the Gentiles for a prayer sanctuary, thus nullifying the first witness. Seeing that the altogether too hastily assembled witnesses bore no fruit with which to convict the prophet, Caiaphas abandoned this line of testimony. He stood and appealed to Christ, hoping to get the conviction from his own lips. Do you answer nothing? What is this that these witness against you? But the Son of Man was silent and answered not a word. Jesus was not bound by law to defend himself, and there was nothing of substance to defend against. Legally, he was safe from conviction. Then the law-breaking chief magistrate, in his diabolical zeal to nail Christ before sundown, broke another law and questioned the witness himself, fishing for a conviction. Are you the Messiah, the Son of God? And he broke still another law and adjured him by the living God to answer what was illegally asked, but refused. This Jesus felt compelled to answer, for the legal magistrate adjured him by God to answer. It is as you have said, I am, Jesus admitted. Furthermore, I say to all of you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming upon the clouds of heaven. Now that he had admitted messiahship, he knew his body was as good as nailed to the cross. He might as well give them the rest of it. The high priest, wanting to make as big a show of this admission and use it as his ticket, stood and ripped his expensive garments, crying out in feigned anguish of spirit, he has spoken blasphemy! What for the need of we of witnesses? Behold, you judges have heard his blasphemy. What is your judgment? Thus violating the law again by leading the judges. He is worthy of death, all shouted, but three, who kept silent and feared for their lives. How do you vote, Nicodemus? Caiaphas asked, satisfied with the overwhelming vote. He has not been legally judged guilty of death in accordance with Jewish law, he answered. And Joseph and Jacob affirmed the same on the principles that they had always stood for, And all the council knew in their hearts that these three men were the only men of justice and integrity on the bench. But they cared not in the case of one who was wrecking their nation. If legal law could not prevail against him, then illegal law must. He must be stopped at all costs. It was assumed that Jesus was not the Messiah, although Christ's ministry had all the signs. No one even considered that before Christ was put to death, they would have to prove he was not the Messiah. Satisfied, the Chief Justice ordered the court's verdict and the admission by the accused to be brought to the Sanhedrin, where the full council could again meet, this time in the legal daytime, and act quickly on the solid information gained in the illegal night before the city was awake. Of course, even the day court was illegal because it was now the Passover, but even the legalistic Pharisees and Sadducees found ways to get around that which they wanted to get around badly enough. They would overrule the law and justify the invented exception. And Nicodemus and Joseph knew it would do no good to protest the illegality of the high priest's actions. Christ was led out of the hall, down the steps, and through the hallway to be held in custody until they were ready to escort him to the Supreme Court, a short distance away, near to the temple wall. Jesus, being left with the temple guards, began to get visitors. Sanhedrists, who in their devilish hatred and delight at finally getting the upper hand over this all-wise one, who made such a fool of them before all, came to seek revenge. Had not this madman drove out the money changers and merchants from the temple court? Had he not robbed them, chief priests, of the gain that fell to them? Now it was their turn at the whip. Several of them spit in the face of God's beloved son, till he was forced to close one eye due to the spittle in it. And they struck God's darling with a knuckled fist, raising welts on his cheek and jaw. Blood ran from his loosened teeth, and one eye began to swell shut. Curses against the anointed one filled the air. Now that this noisy kennel had bayed out the answer of guilty of death, and the comedy of legal pretense was played to the full, the devil's band had their turn abusing him before he was legally condemned, contrary to the law. The high priest had lost a garment, a small price for this glorious victory. Now he let it hang in torn pieces, both inner and outer garments, like glorious symbols of victorious battle. He did not know that by this death sentence, Jesus would abolish the priesthood of Aaron and Levi forever in the eyes of God, and that soon the resurrected one would become God's high priest, and a new priesthood of believers in him would begin, and that in 40 years the temple would lie in ruins. And the elders of the Jews went apart to take counsel and secure the governor's approval of the verdict of the Sanhedrin, sure to speedily follow. Jesus was thrown as prey to the rabble in the palace, and he knew his end had come. They must have their amusement to satisfy the demons within them. Their bestial natures had their way. The captives of Christ, waiting for foreign authority to confirm the death sentence of the only innocent one, meant to give Christ a foretaste of his sufferings. Taking permission to jest with the King of Glory, they enjoyed their devilment on one who would not fight back. He was condemned to death by the highest and holiest tribunal. Why not sport with him? He would not live anyway. Let him become all laughingstock, they said to themselves. He did not complain, so why kill? He did not weep, so why weep over his abuse? He only looked on them with compassion, like a father looks on a sick child. So he doesn't seem to mind. So they vomited out their words in the purest of the pure, his holiness only making them the more sadistic. Then one of them had a good idea, a fun one. He took a dirty cloth and covered the bleeding, buffeted face of Mary's son, tying the corners behind his head. We will try the prophet to see if he is indeed a prophet, he shouted with glee. And a fast backhand buffeted the mouth of Jesus, the Christ of God. Who struck you? Another shouted with delight. And they all joined into the game, laughing and mocking in a moving circle about Jesus. Prophesy the name, one taunted. Over and over the blows fell upon the uncomplaining face, now swollen purple. Prophesy! Prophesy, old prophet! Who smote you? Don't you know? You don't know! And blasphemies followed. Why did he not answer? Did he not prophesy the fall of the temple? And wars and earthquakes, another temple guard volunteered. And you coming on clouds, another put in, and all laughed. Come to us, our king. And a heavy blow landed on him, and all laughed as he groaned. Has he lost his power? What an easy guess, and he cannot make it. It was I who struck you, one triumphantly asserted, and he struck Jesus again and said, who struck you? And they all thought the question to be so funny now that Christ could see, for the blindfold had been removed. But Caiaphas was in haste. The pack had amused themselves long enough. Take the prisoner to the Sanhedrin, he ordered. And looking on Jesus, he feared that maybe they roughed him up too much for the Sanhedrin and Pontius Pilate. But he inside enjoyed the sight and only wished he could have stopped to have become a part of the party. An hour had passed since Peter's second denial. Jesus was now being led past the open inner court just as the servants and officers there, having heard Peter say enough words to know that he was a Galilean, and having just heard the news that Jesus had been condemned to death, decided to press their suspicions, of which now they felt sure in spite of the man's oath of denial. Of a truth, this man also was with him, and by him they meant the condemned one they had been talking about. Peter just didn't fit into their mold. He was altogether different. He is a Galilean, one of the bond servants of the high priest, a kinsman of the one whose ear Peter had sliced off, said, "Did I not see you in the garden with him?" And those standing by came near to Simon and said, "Surely you are one of them, for your speech betrayeth you and confirms our suspicions." And fear struck Peter's heart. His master was sentenced to death. He would be next. He had seen too many crucifixions. "By the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, I know not this man of whom ye speak. I don't know what you're talking about," he cried out desperately. And immediately the cock crowed the second time. And Jesus, passing by, heard all. And he looked at Peter. And Peter looked toward the tramp of feet and saw the all-knowing, sympathetic, forlorn, loving eyes in the bruised face of his Lord and Messiah. And he remembered the prophecy how that Peter would deny him thrice before the cock crows twice. And he remembered his vehement denial and affirmation that Christ could trust him till death. They would die together. They would enter his kingdom together. And he remembered that Jesus told him that he couldn't come with him, but would follow. And Peter's face turned ashen, and his heart smote him. Deep condemnation filled his soul, and a horrible sorrow got hold of him. He walked away from his accusers who had no power to stop him. And the Jews cared not at all about the denial. They would not need to fear him. They had their prize, and they were in a hurry with him. And the big, bold fisherman hated himself, and he walked out past the porter to the large garden of Caiaphas and wept his heart out, sobbing and sobbing, feeling that his heart would break, wanting to die but feeling unable. He was in the throes of dark misery. Those eyes of Jesus, those compassionate eyes. "Oh, those I told you so, I feel so sorry for you, Peter," eyes. "I did it. I denied him. I denied my Lord. I have no strength. It was all a myth. I denied my friend, my best friend, and now he's gone to die. Lord, I can't bear it. I can't bear it. Help me. Forgive me. Forgive me. Forgive me, Jesus. Forgive me, God." And Peter wept bitterly.